So the overall topic that we're moving into is clear knowing. And yesterday the prologue was on the sort of sorting out the mundane and the supramundane. And today I thought I would begin on taking aspects of insight, and particularly insight into not self, sort of who's in here anyway. And begin with a series of suttas from the Khanda Samyutta, which are the connected discourses on the aggregates. And this is Samyutta 22, and begin with Sutta number 1. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Bhagas at Sungsumara Gira, in the Besakala Grove, the deer park. Then the householder Nakulabhita approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, I am old, Venerable Sir. And Nakulabhita was the Buddha's father in many previous lives. They have a very strong connection. I am old, Venerable Sir, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage, afflicted in body, often ill. I rarely get to see the Blessed One and the bhikkhus worthy of esteem. Let the Blessed One exhort me, Venerable Sir, let him instruct me, since that would lead to my welfare and happiness for a long time. So it is, householder, so it is. This body of yours is afflicted, weighed down, encumbered. If anyone carrying around this body were to claim to be healthy even for a moment, what is that due to other than foolishness? Therefore, householder, you should train yourself thus. Even though I am afflicted in body, my mind will be unafflicted. Thus should you train yourself. Then the householder, Nakulabhita, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's statement, rose from his seat, and having paid homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he approached the Venerable Sariputta. Having paid homage to the Venerable Sariputta, he sat down to one side, and the Venerable Sariputta then said to him, Householder, your faculties are serene, your facial complexion is pure and bright. Did you get to hear a Dhamma talk today in the presence of the Blessed One? Why not, Venerable Sir? Just now I was anointed by the Blessed One with the ambrosia of a Dhamma talk. With what kind of ambrosia of a Dhamma talk did the Blessed One anoint you, householder? Here, Venerable Sir, so he repeats the entire conversation with the Buddha. It was with the ambrosia of such a Dhamma talk, Venerable Sir, that the Blessed One anointed me. Didn't it occur to you, householder, to question the Blessed One further as to how one is afflicted in body and afflicted in mind, and how one is afflicted in body but not afflicted in mind? We would come from far away, Venerable Sir, to learn the meaning of this statement from the Venerable Sariputta. It would be good indeed if the Venerable Sariputta would clear up the meaning of this statement. Then listen and attend closely, householder. I will speak. Yes, Venerable Sir, the householder Nakulabhita replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this. How, householder, is one afflicted in body and afflicted in mind? Here, householder, the uninstructed worldling, who is not a seer of the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who is not a seer of superior persons and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, regards form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. He lives obsessed by the notions, I am form, form is mine. As he lives obsessed by these notions, that form of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of form, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. He regards feeling as self, or self as possessing feeling, or feeling as in self, or self as in feeling. He lives obsessed by the notions, I am feeling, feeling is mine. As he lives obsessed by these notions, that feeling of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of feeling, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. He regards perception as self, or self as possessing perception, or perception as in self, or self as in perception. He lives obsessed by the notions, I am perception, perception is mine. As he lives obsessed by these notions, that perception of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of perception, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. He regards volitional formations as self, or self as possessing volitional formations, or volitional formations as in self, or self as in volitional formations. He lives obsessed by the notions, I am volitional formations, volitional formations are mine. As he lives obsessed by these notions, those volitional formations of his change and alter. With the change and alteration of volitional formations, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. He regards consciousness as self, or self as possessing consciousness, or consciousness as in self, or self as in consciousness. He lives obsessed by the notions, I am consciousness. Consciousness is mine. As he lives obsessed by these notions, that consciousness of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of consciousness, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. It is in such a way, householder, that one is afflicted in body and afflicted in mind. And how, householder, is one afflicted in body, but not afflicted in mind? Here, householder, the instructed noble disciple, who is the seer of the noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, who is the seer of superior persons and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, does not regard form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. He does not live obsessed by the notions, I am form, form is mine. As he lives unobsessed by these notions, that form of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of form, there do not arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. He does not regard feeling as self, or self as possessing feeling, or self as in feeling, or feeling as in self, or self as in feeling. He does not live obsessed by the notions, I am feeling. Feeling is mine. As he lives unobsessed by these notions, that feeling of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of feeling, there do not arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. He does not regard perception as self, or self as possessing perception, or perception as in self, or self as in perception. He does not live obsessed by the notions, I am perception, perception is mine. As he lives unobsessed by these notions, that perception of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of perception, there do not arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. He does not regard volitional formations as self, or self as possessing volitional formations, or volitional formations as in self, or self as in volitional formations. He does not live obsessed by the notions, I am volitional formations. Volitional formations are mine. As he lives unobsessed by these notions, those volitional formations of his change and alter. With the change and alteration of volitional formations, there do not arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. He does not regard consciousness as self, or self as possessing consciousness, or consciousness as in self, or self as in consciousness. He does not live obsessed by the notions, I am consciousness, consciousness is mine. As he lives unobsessed by these notions, that consciousness of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of consciousness, there do not arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. It is in such a way, householder, that one is afflicted in body, but not afflicted in mind. This is what the Venerable Sariputta said, elated the householder Nakulapitta, delighted in the Venerable Sariputta statement. that's a basic outline of the clinging to self, and it's so important to be bringing that into the practice, because that's the crux of where all the suffering arises. And that's it. That's sort of the fundamental delusion that we carry around with us, that keeps us sort of cycling in and out of suffering. And that's also that's why that first a fetter that is relinquished is the Sakkaya Ditti, the belief in the body embodiment, or in the being that we identify with any of these things, and then create a me, a self, and we continue to suffer with that. So that in terms of putting forth effort, this is really where effort needs to be pointed towards. I'll read the next sutta number 2. These are these first suttas in the Khanda Samyutta, are sort of laying out the structures that the Buddha taught this whole his teaching of non-self. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans, where there was a town of the Sakyans named Devadaha. Then a number of westward-bound bhikkhus approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, we wish to go to the western province in order to take up residence there." "Have you taken leave of Sariputta, bhikkhus?" "No, Venerable Sir." "Then take leave of Sariputta, bhikkhus. Sariputta is wise. He is one who helps his brothers in the holy life." "Yes, Venerable Sir," those bhikkhus replied. Now on that occasion, the Venerable Sariputta was sitting not far from the Blessed One in a cassia bush. Then those bhikkhus, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's statement, rose from their seats and paid homage to the Blessed One. Then, keeping him on their right, they approached the Venerable Sariputta. They exchanged greetings with the Venerable Sariputta, and when they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, they sat down to one side and said to him, "Friend Sariputta, we wish to go to the western province in order to take up residence there. We have taken leave of the teacher." "Friends, there are wise Kattiyas, wise Brahmins, wise householders, and wise ascetics who question a bhikkhu when he has gone abroad. For wise people, friends, are inquisitive. What does your teacher say? What does he teach? I hope that you, Venerable Ones, have learned the teachings well, grasped them well, attended to them well, reflected on them well, and penetrated them well with wisdom, so that when you answer, you will state what has been said by the Blessed One and will not misrepresent him with what is contrary to fact, so that you will explain in accordance with the Dhamma, and no reasonable consequence of your assertion would give ground for criticism. We would come from far away, friend, to learn the meaning of this statement from the Venerable Sariputta. It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would clear up the meaning of this statement." "Then listen and attend closely, friends. I will speak." "Yes, friend," those bhikkhus replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this: "There are, friends, wise Kattiyas, wise Brahmins, wise householders, and wise ascetics who question a bhikkhu when he has gone abroad. For wise people, friends, are inquisitive. What does your teacher say? What does he teach? Being asked thus, friends, you should answer. Our teacher, friends, teaches the removal of desire and lust." "When you have answered thus, friends, there may be wise Kattiyas, so on, wise ascetics, who will question you further. For wise people, friends, are inquisitive. In regard to what does your teacher teach? The removal of desire and lust. Being asked thus, friends, you should answer. Our teacher, friends, teaches the removal of desire and lust for form, the removal of desire and lust for feeling, the removal of desire and lust for perception, the removal of desire and lust for volitional formations, the removal of desire and lust for consciousness. When you have answered thus, friends, there may be wise Kattiyas, and so wise ascetics, who will question you further. For wise people, friends, are inquisitive. Having seen what danger does your teacher teach the removal of desire and lust for form, for feeling, for perception, for volitional formations, for consciousness? Being asked thus, friends, you should answer thus. If, friends, one is not devoid of lust, desire, affection, thirst, passion, and craving in regard to form, then with the change and alteration of form there arise in one sorrow, lamentation, pain, despair, displeasure, and despair. If, friends, one is not devoid of lust, desire, affection, thirst, passion, and craving in regard to feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, then with the change and alteration of consciousness there arise in one sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. Having seen this danger, our teacher teaches the removal of desire and lust for form, the removal of desire and lust for feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. When you have answered thus, friends, there may be wise Kattiyas, wise ascetics, who will question you further. For wise people, friends, are inquisitive. Having seen what benefit does your teacher teach the removal of desire and lust for form, for feeling, for perception, volitional formations, consciousness? Being asked thus, friends, you should answer thus. If, friends, one is devoid of lust, desire, affection, thirst, passion, and craving in regard to form, then with the change and alteration of form, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair do not arise in one. If one is devoid of lust, desire, affection, thirst, passion, and craving in regard to feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, then with the change and alteration of consciousness, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair do not arise in one. Having seen this benefit, our teacher teaches the removal of desire and lust for form, the removal of desire and lust for feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness. If, friends, one who enters and dwells amidst unwholesome states could dwell happily in this very life without vexation, despair, and fever, and if, with the breakup of the body, after death, he could expect a good destination, then the Blessed One would not praise the abandoning of unwholesome states. But because one who enters and dwells amidst unwholesome states dwells in suffering in this very life, with vexation, despair, and fever, and because he can expect a bad destination with the breakup of the body after death, the Blessed One praises the abandoning of unwholesome states. If, friends, one who enters and dwells amidst wholesome states would dwell in suffering in this very life, with vexation, despair, and fever, and if, with the breakup of the body after death, he could expect a bad destination, then the Blessed One would not praise the acquisition of wholesome states. But because one who enters and dwells amidst wholesome states dwells happily in this very life, without vexation, despair, and fever, and because he can expect a good destination with the breakup of the body after death, the Blessed One praises the acquisition of wholesome states. This is what the Venerable Sariputta said, elated. Those bhikkhus delighted in the Venerable Sariputta statement. Okay, I'll continue with sutta number 3. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Venerable Mahakachana was dwelling among the people of Avanti on Mount Papata at Kururagara. Then the householder, Halindakani, approached the Venerable Mahakachana, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, Venerable Sir, this was said by the Blessed One in the questions of Magandhya in the Attika Vaga, which is in the Sutta Nipata. Having left home to roam without abode, in the village the sage is intimate with none. Rid of sensual pleasures, without expectations, he would not engage people in dispute. How, venerable sir, should the meaning of this, stated by the Blessed One in brief, be understood in detail? The form element, householder, is the home of consciousness. One whose consciousness is shackled by lust for the form element is called one who roams about in a home. The feeling element is the home of consciousness. One whose consciousness is shackled by lust for feeling, for the feeling element, is called one who roams about in a home. The perception element is the home of consciousness. One whose consciousness is shackled by lust for the perception element is called one who roams about in a home. The volitional formations element is the home of consciousness. One whose consciousness is shackled by lust for the volitional formations element is called one who roams about in a home. It is in such a way that one roams about in a home. And how, householder, does one roam about homeless? The desire, lust, delight, and craving, the engagement and clinging, the mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies regarding the form element, these have been abandoned by the Tathagata, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated so that they are no more subject to future arising. Therefore, the Tathagata is called one who roams about homeless. The desire, lust, delight, and craving, the engagement and clinging, the mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies regarding the feeling element, the perception element, the volitional formations element, the consciousness element, these have been abandoned by the Tathagata, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated so that they are no more subject to future arising. Therefore, the Tathagata is called one who roams about homeless. It is in such a way that one roams about homeless. And how, householder, does one roam about in an abode? By diffusion and confinement in the abode consisting in the sign of forms, one is called one who roams about in an abode. By diffusion and confinement in the abode consisting in the sign of sounds, the sign of odors, the sign of tastes, the sign of tactile objects, the sign of mental phenomena, one is called one who roams about in an abode. And how, householders, does one roam about without abode? Diffusion and confinement in the abode consisting in the sign of forms, these have been abandoned by the Tathagata, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated so that they are no more subject to future arising. Therefore, the Tathagata is called one who roams about without abode. Diffusion and confinement in the abode consisting in the sign of sounds, the sign of odors, the sign of tastes, the sign of tactile objects, the sign of mental phenomena. These have been abandoned by the Tathagata, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated so that they are no more subject to future arising. Therefore, the Tathagata is called one who roams about without abode. It is in such a way that one roams about without abode. And how, householder, is one intimate in the village? Here, householder, someone lives in association with lay people. He rejoices with them and sorrows with them. He is happy when they are happy and sad when they are sad, and he involves himself in their affairs and duties. It is in such a way that one is intimate in the village. And how, householder, is one intimate with none in the village? Here, householder, a bhikkhu does not live in association with lay people. He does not rejoice with them or sorrow with them. He is not happy when they are happy and sad when they are sad, and he does not involve himself in their affairs and duties. It is in such a way that one is intimate with none in the village. And how, householder, is one not rid of sensual pleasures? Here, householder, someone is not devoid of lust, desire, affection, thirst, passion, and craving in regard to sensual pleasures. It is in such a way that one is not rid of sensual pleasures. And how, householder, is one rid of sensual pleasures? Here, householder, someone is devoid of lust, desire, affection, thirst, passion, and craving in regard to sensual pleasures. It is in such a way that one is rid of sensual pleasures. And how, householder, does one entertain expectations? Here, householder, someone thinks, may I have such form in the future? May I have such feeling in the future? May I have such perception in the future? May I have such volitional formations in the future? May I have such consciousness in the future? It is in such a way that one entertains expectations. And how, householder, is one without expectations? Here, householder, someone does not think, may I have such form in the future? Such feelings, perceptions, volitional formations, may I have such consciousness in the future? It is in such a way that one is without expectations. And how, householder, does one engage people in dispute? Here, householder, someone engages in such talk as this. You don't understand this Dhamma and discipline. I understand this Dhamma and discipline. What? You understand this Dhamma and discipline? You're practicing wrongly. I'm practicing rightly. What should have been said before, you said after. What should have been said after, you said before. I'm consistent. You're inconsistent. What you took so long to think out has been overturned. Your thesis has been refuted. Go off to rescue your thesis, for you're defeated. Or disentangle yourself if you can. It is in such a way that one engages people in dispute. And how, householder, does one not engage people in dispute? Here, householder, someone does not engage in such talk as this. You don't understand this Dhamma discipline, and so on and so forth. It is in such a way that one does not engage people in dispute. Thus, householder, when it was said by the Blessed One in the questions of Magandhya of the Attakavaga, having left home to roam without abode, in the village the sage is intimate with none. Rid of sensual pleasures, without expectations, he would not engage people in dispute. It is in such a way that the meaning of this, stated in brief by the Blessed One, should be understood in detail. I don't think so. I'd have to check and see. It's in the Attakavaga. No. No, this is the Magandhya that he offered his daughter as a wife to the Buddha. The Buddha didn't accept.
I have a question. In that last passage, it seemed like a lot of the examples were about certain behaviors that one could avoid, associating with the townspeople or fighting into arguments, etc. Yeah. The examples about the feelings of lust and desire and all this stuff arising.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's sort of the whole purpose of the practice, really. That you're, as you continue to recognize how the mind works and what it picks up on, and then how it runs with it, then you start to see, and then you start seeing the complications and the pain involved in that. And then you're able to relinquish the actual tendency toward the picking up of lust or desire, and that it just doesn't. I mean, you can make that conscious choice.
So you begin to see more subtly where feelings are beginning to
yeah.
cross the lake.
Yes, exactly.
Just let it go.
Right, you let it go at that. Yeah, it never really actually comes together as it starts to move in terms of there's a very good exchange that Ajahn Sumedho had with Ajahn Chah one time. This is in early days of Wat Pho Phong still, when Ajahn Chah wasn't very well known and not many people came to Wat Pho Phong. And then this one day a group came, and Ajahn Sumedho was sitting with Ajahn Chah, and in the group was a young woman who was very sort of modernly dressed, as opposed to what you would normally see in the northeast of Thailand in those days. Sort of a short skirt and quite young, attractive. And after the group left, then Ajahn Chah sort of leaned over and Ajahn Sumedho said, "You see that woman? See that young woman?" "Yeah." "So, was she beautiful?" "Yeah." "So, you like that?" "Yeah." "Would you want something like that?" "No." He said, "That's top, my top, ow, my ow." So he said that Ajahn Chah used that a lot after, because in teaching, and said in that sense, yeah, the mind is moves in that direction, but it doesn't pick it up as a real possibility. So it doesn't it recognizes. I mean, you can see something that's attractive or unattractive, or you see something that's desirable or undesirable, but then the mind doesn't really go into it and engage in it. And by its non-engagement on that level, then it's, because it doesn't entertain the proliferations that normally would start to constellate and then move one to action, or just keep on just revolving around and around inside. Next sutta is sutta number 5 in this Kanda Samyutta. Thus have I heard at Savati. There the Blessed One said this: "Bhikkhus, develop concentration. A bhikkhu who is concentrated understands things as they really are. And what does he understand as it really is? The origin and passing away of form, the origin and passing away of feeling, the origin and passing away of perception, the origin and passing away of volitional formations, the origin and passing away of consciousness. And what, bhikkhus, is the origin of form? What is the origin of feeling? What is the origin of perception? What is the origin of volitional formations? What is the origin of consciousness? Here, bhikkhus, one seeks delight, one welcomes, one remains holding. And what is it that one seeks delight in? What does one welcome, and to what does one remain holding? One seeks delight in form, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As a consequence of this, delight arises. Delight in form is clinging. With one's clinging as condition, existence comes to be. With existence as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. One seeks delight in feeling, in perception, in volitional formations, in consciousness, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As a consequence of this, delight arises." And it goes through that whole sequence again. Delight arises. Delight in form is clinging. With one's clinging as condition, existence comes to be. With existence as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. This, bhikkhus, is the origin of form, This is the origin of feeling. This is the origin of perception. This is the origin of volitional formations. This is the origin of consciousness. And what, bhikkhus, is the passing away of form? What is the passing away of feeling? What is the passing away of perception? What is the passing away of volitional formations? What is the passing away of consciousness? Here, bhikkhus, one does not seek delight. One does not welcome. One does not remain holding. And what is it that one does not seek delight in? What doesn't one welcome? To what doesn't one remain holding? One does not seek delight in form, does not welcome it, does not remain holding to it. As a consequence of this, delight in form ceases. With the cessation of delight comes cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of existence. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Similarly, one does not seek delight in feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. Does not welcome it, does not remain holding. As a consequence of this, delight in those things, consciousness ceases. With the cessation of delight comes the cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of existence. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This, bhikkhus, is the passing away of form. This is the passing away of feeling. This is the passing away of perception. This is the passing away of volitional formations. This is the passing away of consciousness. This next one is Sangyutta 22, Sutta number 47. Atsavati. Bhikkhus, those ascetics and Brahmins who regard anything as self in various ways all regard as self the five aggregates subject to clinging, or a certain one among them. What five? Here, bhikkhus, the uninstructed worldling who is not a seer of the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who is not a seer of superior persons and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, regards form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. He regards feeling as self, and then through that whole formula, perception, volitional formations, consciousness as self, or self as possessing consciousness, or consciousness as in self, or self as in consciousness. Thus, this way of regarding things and the notion, I am, have not vanished in him. As I am has not vanished, there takes place a descent of the five faculties, of the eye faculty, the ear faculty, the nose faculty, the tongue faculty, the body faculty. There is, bhikkhus, the mind. There are mental phenomena. There is the element of ignorance. When the uninstructed worldling is contacted by a feeling born of ignorance contact, I am occurs to him. I am this occurs to him. I will be and I will not be occur to him. And I will consist of form, or I will consist of formless. Now I will be percipient and I will be non-percipient. Or I will be neither percipient or non-percipient. These occur to him. These faculties remain right there, bhikkhus, but in regard to them, the instructed noble disciple abandons ignorance and arouses true knowledge. With the fading away of ignorance and the arising of true knowledge, I am does not occur to him. I am this does not occur to him. I will be and I will not be do not occur to him. I will consist of form, I will consist of form, I will be formless does not occur to him. I will be percipient does not occur to him. I will be non-percipient does not occur to him. Or I will be neither percipient nor non-percipient. This does not occur to him. The next one is Sutta number 49. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Arajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. Then Sona, the householder's son, approached the Blessed One, The Blessed One then said to Sona, the householder's son, Sona, when any ascetics and Brahmins on the basis of form, which is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, regard themselves thus, I am superior, or I am equal, or I am inferior. What is that due to apart from not seeing things as they really are? When any ascetics and Brahmins on the basis of feeling, on the basis of perception, on the basis of volitional formations, on the basis of consciousness, which is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, regard themselves thus, I am superior, or I am equal, or I am inferior. What is that due to, apart from not seeing things as they really are? Sona, when any ascetics and Brahmins do not, on the basis of form, which is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, regard themselves thus, I am superior, or I am equal, or I am inferior, what is that due to, apart from seeing things as they really are? When any ascetics and Brahmins do not, on the basis of feeling, on the basis of perception, on the basis of volitional formations, on the basis of consciousness, which is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, regard themselves thus, I am superior, or I am equal, or I am inferior, what is that due to, apart from seeing things as they really are? What do you think, Sona? Is form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Venerable Sir. Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are volitional formations permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Sona, any kind of form whatsoever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all forms should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Any kind of feeling whatsoever, any kind of perception whatsoever, any kind of volitional formations whatsoever, any kind of consciousness whatsoever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all consciousness should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Seeing thus, Sona, the instructed noble disciple experiences disenchantment towards form, disenchantment towards feeling, disenchantment towards perception, disenchantment towards volitional formations, disenchantment towards consciousness. Experiencing disenchantment, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge, it's liberated. He understands, destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. So that was a nice twist on the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, sort of in that, which is the sort of the main or first treatise that the Buddha gave on not self, the first introduction to non self, that formula of what is form. Permanent or impermanent, what is impermanent, suffering, subject to change, is it fit to be regarded as his mind? But then starting that off with that, anything that, whenever anybody regards themselves as either superior or equal or inferior, it's always on the basis of either form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, or consciousness. And all of those things are impermanent, suffering, and subject to change. And why would anybody do that? Because we do it all the time. But that's, you know, when the Buddha sort of lays it out like that, it's like, yeah, right, go. Well, when will I wake up? Okay, any questions?